Okay, so I'm here with Leon Chaito today. We're very pleased to be able to speak to Leo. Thank you so much, Leon, for coming to speak with us today. It's really nice to meet you. And first of all, so just for some of our listeners that haven't met you before or perhaps don't know too much about you, I just wonder if we can, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, about your work and some of the things that you do.
Starting from when?
Whenever you like.
Okay, so I'm a UK-trained registered osteopath, and I've been in practice since 1960, which means a long, long time. I've been writing since the early 70s, numerous books, and editing the Journal of Bodywork and Movement Therapy since the mid-90s. And I work, when I'm in the UK, I see, I work clinically as well as teaching, and I was at the University of Westminster, now I've retired from that. I teach where I'm invited, around Europe and in the States. I live in Greece most of the time, and, well, that's about it, I think.
So you say you've been writing for a really long time, and I read on your website that you've edited or authored over 70 books. Is that correct?
Well, it's nearer 100 now, but a lot of them wouldn't qualify as books. Let's say in the 70s and 80s, I was writing for the lay public. I was writing what you might call popular health titles. It's in 92, 93. Elsevier invited me to write a book on muscle energy technique, and that turned into a series of other modalities, positional release and neuromuscular techniques. And then out of that, my link with Elsevier evolved into the journal editing and a number of other books. So I would say about a dozen real books, and the rest I would regard as popular health type titles.
Still, even a dozen real books, as you describe, and that's an awful lot of writing. You must quite like writing.
I enjoy the process. I enjoy it because the environment in which I work has been created by my wonderful wife, and she supports that, gives me that environment where I can focus in Greece. My wife is Greek. And she put up with living in this country for 25 years, and now I'm putting up with living in Greece. I think I got the best of the deal.
I think you probably have there, yes.
So we have a lovely life in Greece, and I can work 7, 8, 9 hours a day writing and still enjoy the environment. You can get a lot of work done that way. I can't do much writing when I'm in the UK, so I do the other things, do my clinical work and do some teaching.
But I think from our profession, I'd like to extend a thank you to your wife for providing you a great writing environment so that we can have all these great books from you.
I try to find the right words every time I put in an acknowledgement in a book, and I say, I can only describe it as a warm and loving environment. It is exactly what it says. It's an environment which allows me to focus on the work and to swim and to walk and to, relax a little. It's a lifestyle that suits me at my age and allows me to go on functioning.
Well, that's great. So maybe we could talk a little bit about your recent book, or the book that we're featuring on Physiopedia in April. The book is called Recognizing and Treating Breathing Disorders. Now, you first published it in 2002, and it's just been republished. And I, as I understand it, there's been quite a few changes. So perhaps you could tell us just a little bit about the book. What brought about the book, and maybe how it's moved on.
Okay, it becomes a little bit personal because I thought I understood breathing until the mid 90s when I was doing a video for my first book for Elsevier, having to fly up from London to Edinburgh to do a fairly tight scheduled series of video filmings. And it was a particular day where I had skipped breakfast, had too much coffee, very pressured environment, very hot environment, And around mid-afternoon, I started to get strange tingling sensations down the left side of my body. And I thought, as one does, oh, this is what a stroke feels like, which it wasn't. But by the next day when I was back in London, I went into a full left-sided tetanic contracture.
Wow.
And I was taken off to St. Mary's Paddington, and in the neurology department, they prodded me and poked me and tested me and scanned me, and there was nothing wrong with me. And after a week, the very bright young neurologist who hadn't forgotten what he'd learned in his training said, let's try a voluntary hyperventilation. So 1 minute of hyperventilation and my tetanic contracture came back. So he said, go away, learn how to breathe. And I spent the last 20 odd years trying to learn how to breathe.
That's an amazing story.
Well, it's the truth. And out of that experience, I got, obviously, it becomes somewhat personal and you become somewhat evangelic in terms of everybody breathes badly from that point on. And I made contact with a brilliant physio in New Zealand, Zina Bradley, who'd written a book on hyperventilation, a layperson's book on hyperventilation. And through her, met Chris Gilbert, who's a psychologist working in a pain clinic in San Francisco.
And Chris is a co-editor on the book with you.
Yeah, and Dinah. It's co-authored with Dinah, Chris, and myself. Yeah. And we thought, wouldn't it be good if we could have the psychological and the physiotherapy and the osteopathic perspectives? And that was the first book in 2002. But of course, since then, well, I've learned more. Dinah's gone on and she's acquired a brilliant partner. She has a clinic in New Zealand, and we decided that when Elsevier eventually agreed to a revised version, which had a slightly different title. First title was Multidisciplinary Approaches to Breathing Pattern Disorders, and this one is Recognizing and Treating Breathing Disorders, a Multidisciplinary Approach. And we thought that was a better title, and we brought in the best people in the world on the topic. So we brought in some of the Dutch researchers and Norwegian researchers into the field, covered the spectrum more widely, brought in top research experts in Tai Chi, in Qigong, in Feldenkrais, in all sorts of different areas which impact on different ways of dealing with breathing disorders. It's important to established. I've had a great problem when I'm teaching this with attracting physios to the courses, because there's a sense in physiotherapy that respiratory problems are diseases, and you have specialized physios who work in that area. The point here is that this is not about disease. This is not about pathology. Yeah. It's about dysfunction. And if people only realized how widespread and how common breathing disorders are, not disease, not talking about chronic obstructive lung disease or asthma or pathology, just people who breathe poorly and have a whole range of symptoms which emerge from that background.
I have to be honest and say that when I saw that we were going to be featuring this book and had a look at the book, I was thinking, respiratory, the cardiopulmonary, exactly. And thinking of that, what do you want to call it? That clinical speciality. And then I read your book and I had a look at your book, and it was almost like an aha moment. It's like, this really fits into every single client that you would ever see.
Because, just follow the sequence, if you like. Firstly, it's extremely widespread. It's far more prevalent in women than men. It is far more prevalent in premenopausal women during the phase premenstrually when progesterone increases. That accelerates breathing. So if you are of a slightly anxious or apprehensive nature, and you're under pressure and under time pressures or exam pressures or work pressures, as we all are in modern life to some extent, the chances are that there are going to be episodic breathing pattern disorder periods in your life when symptoms will appear which you don't relate to your breathing necessarily. And there's a very simple, we put it in as a flow chart in the book, because it's quite educational for patients to actually go through this flow chart, and where we link, and this is all evidence informed, evidence based. It goes back to a lot of the work that was done in the 80s at Addenbrooke's and at Charing Cross Hospital. There was a lot of research into this field, and at that point, you've got a sequence where you start with an interconnection between breathing more rapidly and feeling anxious. And the anxiety can feed the breathing, or the breathing can feed into the anxiety. So you have anxiety, apprehension, stress, whatever you want to call it. And that leads to sympathetic arousal. Now, that's a general sense of alertness and various obvious symptoms. Respiratory rate goes up and blood pressure goes up. And all of that's sort of fairly innocuous, if you like. That doesn't do much. But if that is a repeated or a constant feature of life, then a whole range of changes occur. And one of the most important is that if you're an upper chest or more rapid breather, you're going to lose more carbon dioxide than is appropriate for your metabolic needs. And that leads to something called respiratory alkalosis, which is extremely common. It can take just a couple of minutes. It took me only a minute to get into that state and get my tetanic contracture. Once you're in respiratory alkalosis, the range of symptoms is such that you'll recognize it immediately.
And what are those symptoms?
So if I just take you around that flowchart.
Okay.
So with alkalosis, you get smooth muscle contractures. So the blood vessels narrow. Hemoglobin releases its oxygen less efficiently. So you're going to get less oxygen to the tissues, less oxygen to the brain. Brain fog, fatigue, and that sort of symptom. Pain threshold drops. So everything becomes more sensitive. People become sensitive to light and bright lights and noise. And just generally, it enhances sensitization of whatever other cause there may be. There's going to be overactivity of the accessory and obligatory breathing muscles. So you're going to get a direct link with head, neck, shoulder problems, with scalene, sternomastoid, upper trapezius, all overactive. In some of the research in Norway from the couple who wrote a chapter in the book on their research, you find that in people who breathe with an upper chest pattern more rapidly than usual, a whole range of other muscles get involved, including the other obligatory respiratory muscle, which is quadratus lumborum, and psoas gets involved. So you start getting pelvic imbalances as the diaphragm and the pelvic floor start misfiring and not matching each other in their functionality. So we find a link between breathing and pelvic floor dysfunction. We find the Hodges in Australia and his colleagues, O'Connor and others, Smith, have shown the link between breathing pattern disorders and poor motor control. So you begin to get a picture here of increased pain sensitivity, lowered pain threshold, general feelings of anxiety, apprehension, particular muscle groups which are overactive. Think about it this way. If you're breathing normally, as you are, I can see you there on the video.
It's funny, if I can interrupt you briefly, because my breathing's changed since you've been talking.
If you're breathing normally, you're breathing 15,000 times a day. The two muscles that will fire every time, the muscle that will fire every time you inhale is scalene, and every time you exhale is going to be quadratus. But if you're an upper chest breather, that rate can go up to 25 or 30,000 times a day. Now, that's a repetitive stress.
Wow.
And the link, and remember this, that quadratus actually merges with the diaphragm. So you get imbalances in core stability, in general spinal stability. So the retraining element of it is fascinating, because it's well studied. You can rehabilitate a poor breathing pattern, but you can rehabilitate it more effectively if you also work on the structures of the body. So if you mobilize the thoracic spine, if it's restricted, and the intercostals, and mobilize the diaphragm area. So we find, very much as in the 80s and in early 90s at Charing Cross. Peter Nixon was doing work on breathing there. He was in the cardiology department. And at Adam Brooks, Professor Lum was working with anxiety states. They found that by a combination of breathing retraining and physiotherapy, they could get excellent results in rehabilitation. And all of that work has gone now. I mean, it's forgotten. It's all in. If you do a data search using the look at the work of Peter Lum and Peter Nixon. Remarkable work. But that's back in the 80s. No one's doing this work now, except people like Dinah Bradley in New Zealand. And there are a group of physios who are still working in this area, and some osteopaths. There's some very good ones working in breathing. And in Holland and in Norway in particular, there's good work being done, but nothing that I know of in the UK.
And I'm sure most of that work's been brought together in your book as well, I'm sure.
That's what we've tried to do. We've brought in some of the Dutch researchers, and some of the others. We've got an excellent physio who works at the Brompton, who's done work on breathing and speech rehabilitation. We've got another New Zealand physio with her work on breathing and the athlete. There are great issues of dysfunction in athletics. Related to overbreathing or poor breathing patterns.
Yeah. So from listening to you, and you're doing a really nice description of breathing pattern disorders, it sounds to me like this should be something that, as physios, we have in our toolbox that we bear in mind with every single patient that we see.
That's exactly my point, that it's not difficult to spot these, and there's some very simple non-invasive assessments. I mean, you can a proper assessment requires a capnograph where you check the carbon dioxide levels, but there are, one of the chapter contributors in the book, Professor van Dixhoorn from Holland, he developed in the 80s a very well validated questionnaire which identifies to about 90% accuracy the probability of hyperventilation. It takes 1 minute for the patient to just tick boxes, and it gives you so the Nijmegen questionnaire is validated, it's easy, so you can get a strong suggestion from the patient's symptoms, from their mannerisms, when you're taking a case history, and then you just do a simple questionnaire, and if you're in any doubt, then capnography gives you a definitive, yes, the carbon dioxide levels are low, and that may be something that happens now and then, or it may be constant. And so every physio who's treating pain or dysfunction should know about this.
Yeah,
and it's not difficult to deal with.
When these patients are sitting in front of us, can we recognise them easily?
I think it's extremely easy. I mean, there are some clues. You'll see two or three mannerisms. People will try and take a breath into space that doesn't exist. They haven't breathed out adequately. So you'll see this sort of fish out of water attempt to breathe in to space that doesn't exist. Or you'll see sighing or yawning, which are ways of the body creating an equilibrium with the carbon dioxide. Or if the person's tolerance to carbon dioxide has been modified by their breathing habit, then if they're sitting quietly or they're a little bit slow in their breathing because you're in a nice quiet environment, or if they're a little bit anxious, then you'll see signs of sighing or this sort of air hunger type symptom. And the general symptoms, very easy to evaluate. You see shoulders rising and falling. You shouldn't actually see that. If you can actually see sternomastoids quivering at you, and I can see yours, you shouldn't actually be able to see the sternomastoid. Yes, I think that's
it. Just for everyone listening, I'm now doing my collar up.
it's not difficult to spot, but you can't make a diagnosis that way, but you can certainly get a clue. And then the questionnaire takes about a minute. There are 16 questions or symptoms that the patient ticks a box of, I have this symptom never or frequently or very frequently, and they score points based on that. All of the symptoms, and this, we are always careful to say this to the patients, none of these symptoms are necessarily caused by your breathing, but all of them can be aggravated by your breathing. And if you've got a cluster of them, it points towards a possibility, probability. Then it we need to actually test. So we use capnography. Most physios won't have access to taking blood gas type assessment, but capnography, relatively inexpensive and available. So you can recognize it and you can deal with it. Now the problem comes, and this I was teaching this last weekend in Dublin on the subject, and if someone comes to you and they have a neck problem or a shoulder problem, the last thing they want you to start saying is, well, you know, yes, you've got a neck and a shoulder, but actually it's your breathing. So somehow you have to broaden the discussion. And if it emerges that they are also concerned about other symptoms, and you can educate them to or give them an awareness, then it can become part of a treatment approach. But I guess you can't just simply say to a patient, yeah, I know you've got a bad neck, but I'm going to work on your breathing.
It's one of those things that should be part of our toolbox, isn't it? And it comes out when it's needed and when it's appropriate.
And I think what you'll also find is that most people, they're aware that there are times when they have breathing issues. I just want to emphasize one, because it comes into one point. It follows on from what I said earlier about air hunger. That one of the most important elements in breathing retraining is that we don't teach people how to breathe in. We teach them how to breathe out. It's a lack of full exhalation is what leads to rapid upper chest breathing, half out, half in, and you end up with the upper chest only. And if you can teach people slow exhalation, we use a variety of techniques. Not every one method suits everybody, but there's a whole range of ways of teaching breathing. But there are key elements in it, and like any other homework, because the patient has to do the breathing, they have to do the homework. Like any other form of homework that you give people, compliance is a major problem. So it has to be clustered around absolute understanding of why they're being asked to do what they're being asked to do. And they need to understand the story about how breathing interacts with their symptoms. And then the methods need to be simple, not unpleasant, and not take up too much time. So there's a five-minute morning and evening set of breathing exercises, which modify as time goes by. If they're progressing, you change the pattern a little bit. And I often quote Dinah Bradley, because there was this time when we were doing a part of the book on, I think, on the structural aspects, and I talked about there are patients who do, because there's relative ischemia, and overuse of certain muscles, a lot of people develop trigger point activity. And Dinah says, yes, I know they do, but I don't treat the trigger point. I couldn't care less about. All I do is teach them better breathing, and the trigger points go away. And I thought that was a great insight. She has a strategy. She changed the way I work anyway. She uses an ergometer. She finds trigger points in the intercostals. She measures how much pressure is required to fire them up. And then she does that every time the patient comes. And if they are not improving, if they require the same amount of pressure, she says, you're not doing your homework. And she actually uses the gradual fading away of trigger point activity as a guide to whether they're actually doing their work.
That's an excellent way to motivate your patients.
It taught me something, yes. Yeah. And it actually refocused my interest in, I begin to see trigger points as functional and useful and not something that has to be stabbed to death by dry needling. You use them as a guide to what are the dysfunctional patterns that are producing them. Change those patterns and they go away, and if it's possible. Anyway,
The techniques to change the patterns, are they all in your book, the treatment?
Yes, the techniques are all there. The reason that we brought in a variety of different approaches, indirect approaches and direct approaches. I don't think I've got time to explain
That. But, yeah. What are the most commonly used approaches that physios might use in the clients that they see?
Well, there has to be obviously what the patient is doing. So you teach them a breathing pattern sequence, and it's based on initially on pursed lip breathing, which is using a slow exhalation through pursed lips. That's well validated in treatment of chronic obstructive lung disease, and it's useful because what you're actually doing is creating a small aperture for exhalation, which makes the diaphragm work as it goes back to its resting position. So it's an eccentric exercise for the diaphragm. So you give them pursed lip breathing. You have to work with whatever rhythm they currently can maintain, because it's no good saying, I want you to breathe in for 3 seconds and out for 5 seconds. You have to find what works for the individual. And slowly we want to get a differential where the exhalation is twice as long as the inhalation, but that can take 3 months or 6 months. Initially, you have to work with what you've got. So the pursed lip breathing, and then there are a whole range of strategies to try and inhibit overactivity of the accessory breathing muscle. So we give them various strategies which they can use, 5, 6, or 7 to choose from. They test them. Do this while you're doing the exhalation. Do that while... Anyway, there's a whole range of those. And that's, again, individualized. So they find, I like to do my breathing in this position or when I'm doing that. Do you want me to go into detail about that?
No, that's fine. Because there's the retraining of the breathing is only a part of it, really, isn't it? Then it's also to enable them to be able to breathe properly again. It's important to look at thoracic mobility and things like
almost
that.
Almost always, there, if it's been going on for any length of time, there's going to be a degree of, call it rigidity or lack of mobility in the thoracic spine. We tend to work on mobilizing those areas very gently and give them some self-stretching if they want to do it, and mobilization. That's extremely important. There are also nutritional aspects, because what was found in the 90s, I can't remember who, anyway, so it's in the book, found that if you have a tendency towards hyperventilation, overbreathing, and remember that hyperventilation is the extreme of a breathing pattern disorder. Most of the patients we see are not hyperventilating. They're somewhere in the range where they're heading gently that way.
To be clear, the breathing pattern disorder, it's a disorder of overbreathing.
It's an overbreathing pattern, but it doesn't necessarily reach the extreme of hyperventilation.
Yeah.
But you're heading that way. But the point I was going to make was that Brostov, that was Professor Brostov who noted this, that if you have a tendency to overbreathe, to be an upper chest breather, and you have, even within the normal range of blood sugar, but in the low normal blood sugar levels, it will exacerbate the symptoms. So we encourage people to have regular meals and not be on a high sugar diet and all of that stuff. So nutrition comes into it. Not too peripherally, because very often you'll find people who, I only have time for a coffee in the morning and I skip lunch. Well, that, if you're also in that spectrum heading towards hyperventilation, it's going to aggravate it. It's going to be that much more symptomatic.
And it's interesting how it comes into a much more holistic approach then, and that's perhaps something that physiotherapists don't always... perhaps they don't have the time, we're very time pressed and things, and maybe we don't always look at that complete holistic approach. We certainly don't look at nutrition as a routine. And then I guess also looking at your book, one of the really interesting pieces in the preface is that about text messaging and modern technology and how that affects our breathing disorder patterns.
That's a piece of research. They took 12 experienced texters, university students, who were all texting all the time. And then they checked their scalene activity, I think the skin resistance to electricity, they checked their breathing rate. Various parameters were measured while they were texting and while they were receiving text messages. And their breathing rate accelerated. It's very interesting. And many of them had symptoms which they didn't relate to the fact that it was connected to their breathing.
But that's really interesting, isn't it, as well? Because I imagine, I can totally see how that would relate to a sedentary person or an office worker. So now that we sit a lot more and we don't move around as much, people playing video games, things like that, how that is all going to affect.
There's actually meant to be an evolutionary link here. I think there was a paper, which we've given the details of in the book, which links, there's an entrainment between movement of the limbs and the breathing rate. There's another study which actually shows what happens where just sitting, and someone is sitting quietly, and then they put their fingers on the keyboard, and then they start typing. And if you measure their breathing rate, and you measure scalene activity, and you measure various other, you see how that rate goes up. So as the limbs move faster, it automatically triggers more rapid breathing. It's as though we're running and chasing antelopes, or whatever we did when we were running and chasing antelopes. So there's an entrainment between the breathing rate and limb movement, and even down to texting, that's still limb movement. That's hypothetical, but yeah. I think there are many things that are happening in modern life which we don't necessarily correlate with problems of this sort. And what one of the phrases I'm reminded of constantly when people say, what is the cause of overbreathing? Okay, it can be an emotional response to environmental stresses. Lum, who I mentioned before, made a very sort of significant statement to me at any rate. He said, almost irrespective of the origins of a breathing pattern disorder, by the time you see the patient, it's become a habit. Yeah. And I try to help patients to get that sense of what do you mean by a habit. And I say, well, okay, look at how I'm sitting. I'm sitting with my head forward, my shoulders rounded, my posture is terrible. This is my postural habit. And I said, let's look at you. And they're usually sitting similar. We all do. And I say, okay, I did some Alexander training many, many years ago. So I do know how to get my head more or less into its correct position. And I said, how long will that last? Maybe a minute or two, and then I'll be back down there again. I said, that's a habit. It's not a disease. Poor posture, poor breathing, both habits. To change a habit is not easy. We know that from many other examples. So how do we go about it? We go about it by trying to remind the body of how it's what an Alexander teacher would do in posture, gradually getting you acclimatized to feeling right when you're being put into a correct posture and the current slump feeling wrong. And we have to change the setting, if you like, in the respiratory center of the brain, where your body has become acclimatized to a set point of carbon dioxide levels, so that if you breathe slowly, carbon dioxide levels will rise and you'll feel panicky. I've got to breathe faster. So one of the simplest tests we use, and it's not diagnostic, but it gives you a clue, is breathe out and hold your breath out until the very first sign you need to breathe in. Normal, there is no normal, but normal would be somewhere in the 20-25 second range, somewhere over there. Someone who hyperventilates is going to be 3, 4, or 5 seconds, similar to an asthmatic. So what are the triggers of breathing pattern disorder? Who knows? Acidosis will do it. In advanced stages of pregnancy, it's more likely that you'll breathe more rapidly, but then it's physiological. Mm-hmm. It's normal to hyperventilate when you're running. You need to get rid of acid wastes. So there are times when dysfunction is normal.
Yes.
And is physiological.
Yes.
But if you're the average individual sitting on a bus or driving your car or having a telephone conversation and your breathing rate is not meeting your metabolic needs, then you're going to create symptoms, and there's a whole range of them.
Yeah, and so when we're thinking about this approach to managing our patients, it's really important to look at lifestyle and just lifestyle in general, and how, and not just for the breathing pattern disorders, but you know, we should be looking at that anyway for what we're treating. The other things that we're treating. So this ties in really well with the breathing pattern disorders, and it may well even indicate them to us before we even take a look at the patient.
Yeah, but your real problem for your, let's say you're a physio and you're working with a 20 or 30 minute time slot, and your patient has been sent to you with thoracic pain or shoulder or whatever, introducing breathing into the story is going to be difficult. Being aware of it, you may be able to do something, but I suppose practitioners in private practice are going to have much more scope for this sort of thing. It's very much more difficult in a clinical setting where you are where there are time constraints. But if physios would only apply it to themselves, it would be a huge benefit.
Well, I can tell you, since reading through your book, all this week I have been so aware of my breathing. And although you say my sternocleidomastoid is standing out, I've been really aware of it. And it's really, I think if physios, as long as they're aware of this and then do just start thinking about it themselves, and then it becomes more of a normal thing for them to think about and to integrate into their practice when they can and when it's appropriate. And I think, it's a really, really interesting topic. And I can just see that this might, I don't know what you think about where this is going in the future, but I can see that it may well become a larger problem in the general population because of how we're becoming so overstimulated, because how we're sedentary and how our lifestyles are changing. And, we have just talked about that briefly, but where do you think this might go in the future?
Well, I don't think I can answer the question. I know that since I've been aware of it, I'm far more aware of, especially in females, especially in younger females, and maybe it is just the sheer pressure of everything. Very often, just to go back to the difficulty of, I'm trying to see what it's like for the physio who's got just 20, 30 minutes, and they recognize something here. One of the simplest things they can do is just not address the breathing pattern disorder, but recommend Tai Chi. I don't send patients to yoga, because there are so many different forms of yoga, and a good relaxing type yoga session where breathing is a main focus, slow breathing is a main focus, that can be excellent. But unless you know the yoga teacher, it's not a good idea. But Tai Chi is a wonderful, and there are many, many studies, and we've got a chapter in the book by Dr. Chan from Hong Kong on this, how because the individual is focusing on, if you like, the story of what they're trying to replicate, where they're opening up and closing down movements, and this foot has to go there and this arm has to go there and I have to do this slowly, they're focusing on something other than the breathing, but breathing is built into it, and that's the subtle way.
Yeah.
What we try to avoid is people thinking about their breathing all the time, because the first thing you get is, I've got to breathe in like this, I've got to breathe. It just creates another layer of tension. So I say to patients from the beginning, forget about how you breathe in. Your body knows how to breathe in. Learn how to breathe out. As long as you can breathe out slowly through pursed lips, the in-breath takes care of itself. But if you're only half breathing out, you can only half breathe in. Or go to a Tai Chi class.
Yeah, that's really great advice. I think from what we've talked about, it's really great that you've been able to come on today and just talk to us about this, because I think it's really important for physios to be aware of these breathing pattern disorders, which is, as we've been talking about, is over breathing and upper chest breathing, and at the far extreme is hyperventilation. So if we can recognize these things, there are some simple techniques that we can introduce into our practice in relation to the mechanical things like the thoracic mobility, the muscle, shortened muscles, overactive muscles, things like that. And then, if we have time, if we're in the private setting and we have time to do some breathing re-education, then that's all very well. But if not, then, there's the simple technique of thinking about your exhalation, and if not, just go to Tai Chi. I think that's really good advice, and I hope I've summed that up.
And don't forget to have breakfast.
And don't forget to have breakfast and
So that's the story of that. And what's interesting for me was it immediately shifted my focus into that area rather than where I had been before in my osteopathy. And from there, there was a natural progression to pelvic floor dysfunction because the two diaphragms worked together. And I then linked up with a physio who's now a doctor of physical medicine, Ruth Jones, and we did a book on chronic pelvic pain. And that has a whole lot about breathing in it. So the issues are, the body is connected, and you can't sort of say, oh, I'm going to focus on breathing only. But breathing has to be brought into, if you're treating the whole person, it's so fundamental.
So we mustn't forget breathing. Mustn't forget breathing. And that, so I think maybe we could move on at that point. That ties in quite well to your journal of bodywork and movement therapies, which the title there seems to encompass exactly what you've just said, in that, the whole body and the movement system and how the therapies are related to that. So your journal, you're the founding editor of Journal of Bodywork and Movement Therapies, and that's the journal that we're featuring this month as well. And so I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about how that came about. And
well, it was born around the same time as manual therapy was born in the early 90s. And my sense that manual therapy was very much a biomechanical model of care. And there was always physiotherapy, of course, the journal. I felt that there was a neglected area, and that was, but it was a neglected area for good reason, that there hadn't been research, or there wasn't much science related to many of these topics. And it was with great difficulty that Elsevier reluctantly allowed that journal to be born in 95, I think it started. So we're in our 18th or 19th year now. And what I was told quite recently.
Still going strong.
Oh, not only going strong, going stronger.
Good.
We're one of the few journals, they're not the only one, but we're one of the few that are growing in not measured by circulation, measured by downloads. And that's how things are measured now.
Exactly.
So we get 25,000-30,000 downloads a month, which is a lot of papers.
Yeah.
And circulation is people don't read journals cover to cover anymore. They go and they pick this and they pick that, and everything else is left. So the world is changing. So I'm thrilled with that journal's progress. We've introduced two new sections in it since the beginning. We have a prevention rehabilitation section, and I have two associate editors who deal with that, and we've got a new section which started last year on fascia science and clinical applications because of the new interest in fascial function and dysfunction. So we have different subsections, and it's going very, very well, thank you.
And overall, just describe to us, what topics does the journal cover?
Oh goodness me,
is it lots?
Let me find the recent copy. Let's see, which one is this? This is, well, it's April 2012. Do I have a more recent one? I may have a more recent one. This one is January 2014. Shall I just give you some of the title, some of the topics?
Yeah.
Osteopathic manipulative treatment of congenital talipes equinovarus. A self-efficacy study on pragmatic investigation into the effects of massage therapy on self-efficacy of multiple sclerosis clients. Case study on stroke rehabilitation, developmental physiology, three levels of motor control in the assessment and treatment of motor system, exercise physiology. Oh, hang on. Accuracy of two forms of infrared image analysis of the masticatory muscles and the diagnosis of temporomandibular disorder, a literature review, photographic analysis of human posture, case study on cerebral palsy,
so randomized. Certainly a long list.
That's not even half of the content.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a long list of therapies that cover many different problems that physios may see. So certainly very appropriate to physiotherapies.
If they're interested in the slightly less biomechanical model.
Okay, yeah.
Because we're not flaky, we're not fringe, but we're not as we tend to have a more whole person approach. Obviously, what's submitted gets reviewed, and not everything gets through by a long way. But anyway,
that's quite nice, because many of the journals out there that we see are a very biomedical model sort of thing. And if there's just something that's a little more holistic that's really appropriate for us to have a look at, then that sounds great.
That would be my thinking, but it's not for me to say, is it?
We're going to highlight your journal this month, so we'll recommend that everybody take a look, and hopefully we'll have some more physios looking at that for you.
Do they? Some of them may have online access to it. I don't know.
But some people will have online access. We'll highlight. You should have. I think. Is it the first issue of every year is open access? So we'll be able to highlight a full issue for you for the last one that was open access. So we'll have a link to that in the blog post that goes out with this podcast.
Okay.
So that's great. So we've talked about your book, which is really interesting, your journal, which is fascinating as well. And I guess all that, I don't want to keep you too much longer. We've been chatting, I've taken up quite a bit of your time already, but I guess... we should just mention that you have a website. Everything you do and everything that you've mentioned and all your other books are all linked to from your website.
Well, they're all on there. Are you going to give the website address?
Yeah, I will, yes. It's leonchaitow.com.
.com.
Yeah, so you can have a look at Leon's website. I will also mention that in relation to the book, you've got Elsevier have a site that publishes your... videos.
Yes,
in relation to the book.
If you get the book, it will give you the website address for videos. You go to that website, it'll ask you. It changes all the time. The third word or the fifth word of this paragraph of that chapter. That's your password. You go in. We've got dozens and dozens of videos showing different techniques in the breathing pattern.
So that's great. That's chaitobreathingpattern.com. So that's all the videos that are related to the techniques used in the book. And so that's really useful to use in conjunction with the book. Do you have any other websites we should know about? Are you on Twitter?
That's it. That's the one.
Okay. And are you on Twitter? Can we see you on Twitter?
Oh, I'm on Facebook. I don't like Twitter. I don't want to start. I'm looking after my breathing pattern.
Yes, just about to say. That's exactly one of those things that could really make you quite anxious or overstimulated.
No, it's too, how can I put it, too staccato, too short. I like things to have a little bit of length to them.
Okay,
excellent.
We can find you on Facebook and perhaps communicate with you there if anyone wants to talk to you there. I think we've summed up some of the things we've talked about today.
How that, you'll have to edit the... whatever I was saying, it may have come out a bit garbled. I don't know, but anyway, it's an area which I am desperate for practitioners to recognise how important the importance of for themselves and for their patients.
So
do you call your patients or clients nowadays?
It depends where you work, I think. Yeah, so I should probably say clients or individuals, but we do have patients who are in hospital. But I think your key message is for us to gain this knowledge, have this knowledge in our toolkit, and just to bear it in mind when we're seeing our clients or our patients. Which I think is a really good message to have. So definitely something that we should all be aware of.
If you go to my website, there are articles downloadable free of charge, and quite a lot of them are on breathing patterns. So there's a little search window. You put in breathing, and you'll get a list of 10, 15, and you're welcome. Some of them are 5, 10 years old, but they're still valid.
That's great. And we will be doing some educating in our Physiopedia members area this month as well in relation to breathing pattern disorder. So hopefully what we will do is create some pages on Physiopedia that also provide some free and open education, which should really help to promote the idea. Okay,
What you might do, I'm just as an, I don't know, you're going to, I understand, give two chapters of the book. The The foreword by David Peters, Professor Peters, it's only one and a bit pages, but he has summed it up. He's doing a lot of work on what he calls human resilience and at Westminster University. And he sums up in that one page. If you could get that, give that away as well.
Yeah, we can try and get hold of the foreword. That would be good. We'll try and get hold of that and give that away. You're right, it does completely sum it up. I read it.
Yeah, really good.
Okay, that's great. Well, I just want to say thank you very much for talking to us today. I know that everyone that is able to listen to this will be very grateful for your time today. It's been really interesting and fascinating conversation.